Today, Israelis head to the polls to decide if Benjamin Netanyahu will hold on to power for another term. And in opinion, Sherry Smith on the discrimination and hate crimes experienced by British gypsies and travellers.
He has managed to stay in power at the top of the government here for 10 consecutive years, but also way back to 1996.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a very firm fixture in Israeli politics, but he's also hugely divisive. This weekend, in a live TV interview, he said he'd annex Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
A contentious statement seen as a last-minute pre-election promise to appeal to hardline voters, and one already enraging Palestinians and the Arab world.
It's something the far right have called for years, and could seriously damage any hopes for an Israeli-Palestinian deal. For 10 years, as Prime Minister, he's been pulling the country further to the right and has positioned himself as a leader who can keep Israel safe. And his time in office has earned him a nickname.
He's called King Bibi because he has ruled for so long. There are many people here, especially young people, who can't really imagine the country with another prime minister.
Today, Israelis vote on whether or not King Bibi will continue his reign.
Really, this is an election about personality and whether people want to stick with Benjamin Netanyahu or change.
The election is a close call, but Netanyahu is mired in corruption scandals, and there's a hint in the air that some voters won't accept more of the same. From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, is King Bibi and his vision for Israel here to stay? Take me right back to when he was a child. What was his life like?
Benjamin Netanyahu lived between Israel and the United States.
Well, I came for the first time, I think, when I was 8 years old, for about a year. Didn't know a word of English.
His father was an intellectual.
He was a great professor, a great historian, but the way he made his living was that he edited encyclopedias.
Oliver Holmes is the Jerusalem correspondent for The Guardian.
One famous story around his family is that his brother died during a very famous Israeli operation in Uganda.
In 1976, terrorists for the Palestinian cause hijacked an Air France flight from Tel Aviv to Paris and forced it to land in Entebbe, Uganda. They held more than 100 passengers hostage. Then Israeli commandos flew from Israel to Uganda and stormed the terminal. Then one Israeli commando was killed. He was Yoni, or Jonathan Netanyahu.
I don't know how we all dealt with it. I don't know where my parents found the courage to go on. I think the loss of a brother is a terrible thing.
And Netanyahu grew up to get involved in politics, and he rose to prominence in the 90s, which was a period where Israel and the Palestinians were going through a peace process, and there was quite a lot of optimism around that. He emerged after the assassination of an Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, who had forged one of these peace processes.
Israel, a nation in shock, grieves for its murdered leader, Yitzhak Rabin. Hundreds of thousands have been queuing to pay a final tribute to the man who said he was ready to take risks for peace.
And he comes from a right-wing party in Israel called Likud. And since 1996, he has served 13 years in government over four terms, putting him on track to becoming Israel's longest-serving prime minister if he wins this election.
When he came into power in 1996, one of the things he was criticised for was being too inexperienced. Why did he win?
There was a general feeling in the late 90s in Israel of frustration with failing peace processes that had started a few years prior. And there was a backlash against it. And he sort of rode that wave. And there were suicide bombings in that time. And that really garnered him a lot of support.
Those who are on the side of peace must show complete dedication to the fight against terrorism. On the question of security and terrorism, we will not accept the notion that peace and terrorism can coexist under one roof.
So he served 10 consecutive years as prime minister. How has Israel changed under his leadership, do you think?
Well, under Benjamin Netanyahu, certainly within politics, there has been a big change. And that has been this lurch towards the right wing. Now on his cabinet, he has included ultra-nationalists, both religious and secular. And there has been a sort of gradual push away from what used to be the sort of key issue for Israelis, at least when they were voting and in politics, which was moves towards peace with the Palestinians. During the time that he's been in power, that has lessened. And now it's almost completely absent in many respects from a lot of the campaigns of this election.
But what was his initial approach then to the West Bank, to Gaza and a peace settlement?
Netanyahu was against the Oslo Accords, which were a series of measures agreed between Palestinian and Israeli leaders, which would hope to start off a process that would eventually end in a negotiated settlement between the two territories. And Netanyahu was always against that. And he has been quite consistent in that approach. And I guess you can see what he wants by what has happened. And we're in a sort of similar situation, a more entrenched situation than Israel was and the Palestinian territories back when he first came to power.
In recent years, illegal settlement activity in the West Bank has grown. Israel's strengthened its position in Jerusalem. And there have been more than 30,000 Palestinian casualties on the Gaza border in the past year, something that you've reported with us before. What does the prospect of peace look like now?
There aren't any prospects of peace at this exact moment. There's a US-backed peace initiative that Donald Trump has tasked his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, with drafting.
Senior advisor Jared Kushner is making his way through the Mideast this week. He's promoting economic portions of his Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. Now, the Trump administration has called the framework the deal of the century, but few details have been released.
After Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the Palestinian leadership said it refused to accept the U.S. as a mediator anymore, which is its long-standing traditional role. So there are very few prospects. And meanwhile, you know, the situation here on the ground makes it look more and more impossible with, you know, these large settlements in the West Bank, with the Palestinians who are divided between the West Bank and Gaza, both territories where there are different Palestinian political factions in power, and also what seems like a very permanent military occupation run by the Israeli government.
A controversial new law enacted by the Knesset, Israel's parliament, has again stirred deep emotions about the identity of the Jewish state and how Israelis seek to define themselves.
So last year, his administration passed a law officially declaring Israel the nation state of Jewish people, making Hebrew the only official language and downgrading the language of Arabic too. And that was a move that faced global criticism. I mean, how much of a shift did that represent for Israel?
Well, Israel is a diverse country. It is a country founded for the Jewish people, but also one-fifth of its population is not Jewish, the majority of which are Arabs. And when the nation-state law was passed, they were very upset.
On the Knesset floor, Arab lawmakers ripped up the bill. Coalition leader Ayman Odeh pulled out a black flag, and Odeh called the law evil.
They say it effectively passed into law their status as second-class citizens. How much of a new thing that was, they would differ on what they thought. Many people I spoke to after that law was passed said, this has been going on for decades and decades. We have always felt like we are second class.
So as you mentioned, Oliver, peace isn't really on the agenda of these elections. What are voters concerned about?
What Netanyahu and his supporters have been arguing, that there's no other candidate who can keep Israel on the path that he has put it on. His supporters call him Mr. Security because they claim that he has made Israelis safer. He has been playing up how well the economy is doing.
How well is the economy doing?
The economy in Israel is doing very well. And it has been doing well for a long time. There's a very strong high-tech scene here. Israel has a thriving agriculture sector. Of course, there's tourism. What I will say is that Israel is a very expensive place. And like many other developed countries in the world, people have a very high cost of living that doesn't correspond to their wages. So these have been issues that have grown in recent years and become more prominent in the elections. But really, this is an election about personality. This election, the way it's been described to me by many different voters, is it's a referendum on Benjamin Netanyahu.
We begin this hour with new developments out of Israel, where the country's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is expected to be indicted on corruption charges in three different cases. The country's attorney general.
And I suppose the whole election so far has been dominated by another issue completely, because just 6 weeks ago, Israel's attorney general announced dramatic corruption charges against Netanyahu. What was the Prime Minister accused of?
So the Prime Minister is a suspect in three cases. The first one is he is accused of accepting gifts, and these gifts are things like cigars, pink champagne, jewellery for his wife. And it's not quite clear what he gave in exchange for these gifts, but this is one of the cases where the police and the Attorney General have recommended that he be indicted. The next two cases are related to media coverage. One is a alleged deal that he made with a newspaper that has been critical of him. He had allegedly promised to hurt that newspaper's competition that's normally writes quite pro-Netanyahu stories in exchange for better coverage. And in the third and most serious case, Netanyahu has been accused of offering regulatory benefits to an Israeli telecoms company in exchange for positive news stories about him. So these are the main allegations against Netanyahu. He has dismissed all of them as a political witch hunt orchestrated by his political foes, but also the press.
After I read the recommendation report, I can say it is biased, extreme, full of holes, like Swiss cheese.
Netanyahu will now enter a stage where he goes into this pre-trial hearing and he'll be able to defend himself and possibly have it all dropped before it even gets into a trial.
But both the police, though, and the Attorney General have said that he should be indicted. I mean, it doesn't look good for him, does it?
No, it doesn't look good at all. And this comes after a very long period of investigations. These cases have been going on for so long. I feel like many people have already made their mind up whether he is guilty or innocent.
Before the trial?
Before the trial, which won't happen until after the election. And one of the big arguments made by his political opponents is that does Israel need a prime minister who in the morning is going to trial and in the afternoon is trying to run the country?
So who else is a serious contender in this election?
So the other main contender in this election is someone who emerged from nowhere just a few months ago. His name is Benny Gantz, and he is the former Army Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces.
Yes, my friends, I am a soldier. That is who I am. That is what I do.
And you say he's emerged from nowhere. How?
He spent his entire career in the army. He has no political experience. He announced just a few short months ago that he was going to run for prime minister. And this created this sort of snowball effect. It seemed like he was growing more and more popular. He has joined forces with other centrist politicians, and it has got to the point where in some polls he has been shown to be able to win this election.
So in order to even run, he had to create a new political party, the Blue and White Party. So what does he stand for? What are his policies?
He has a few main policies. For example, he has said that he is in support of civil marriage. One issue here is on Shabbat, which is the day of rest in Judaism. He is in support of allowing public transport to continue. That has been a very contentious issue here. And more religious sections of society do not want public transport, or at least not in the areas that they live in. But these are smaller issues compared to his main drive, which has been to present this clean image, this anti-corruption image, and to say, I'm the person who can replace Netanyahu, who is now weighed down with these corruption charges.
Essentially saying, I am not Netanyahu, therefore I'm a good option.
Exactly.
You've been out on the election trails, on the campaigns. What are supporters of Benny Gantz saying about this coming election?
So I was at a Gantz campaign event the other night.
Who needs their treatment?
And it's interesting because he has a really diverse set of supporters. I met this one woman. She was an American Israeli. She was anti-occupation. And she actually said that she had very little in common with Gantz. But for her, it was simply a question of, can I get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu? And this is the calculation that a lot of people are making in their heads. He has tried to appeal to both the left, the center, and the right of Israeli politics to garner enough votes. And in doing so, he has to be both critical of Netanyahu, but at the same time, he doesn't want to isolate himself. And so I went to a campaign event the other day where he was both criticizing Netanyahu for being corrupt, in his words, and at the same time saying that he respected him. At one point, he even compared to himself to Netanyahu, to saying, we're both called Benjamin.
They are both called Benjamin. There's a Benny and a Bibi.
Exactly. So he has tried to play this kind of political acrobatics where he tries to appeal to everyone. And to do that, he has been extremely light on policy.
He's also the former head of the Israel Defense Forces. And we've talked a bit about how peace isn't really on the table at these elections. What's his message around Gaza, around the West Bank?
So he waged the 2014 war against Hamas in Gaza.
I fought in battles you've heard of and in operation you will never will. I commanded complex military operations and painful wars.
And he released a campaign video that was highly criticized. It showed flattened neighborhoods of Gaza, and he was kind of boasting and bragging about how he had ordered these bombing raids, and this was seen as a sort of clear attempt to appease members of the right wing. And at the same time, he has talked up sort of vaguely about the possibility of restarting peace negotiations, but he hasn't been very clear. So he releases mixed messages on that issue.
And of course, the results of this election will be watched around the world. How has Netanyahu positioned Israel on the global stage?
Netanyahu has worked to find allies around the world to fight the fights that he wants to fight. He has been frustrated with EU pressure in regards to the occupation. And so he has made alliances with right-wing authoritarian leaders in Europe in the hopes that they will use their leverage within the European Union.
There's a new anti-Semitism that is expressed in anti-Zionism, that is, in delegitimizing the one and only Jewish state. In many ways, Hungary is at the forefront of the states that are opposed to this anti-Jewish policy, and I welcome it.
He's also made alliances with other nationalist leaders, for example, Modi in India.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on his first ever visit to India.
And then, of course, the famous bromance of the past couple of years has been Netanyahu and US President Donald Trump.
So let's talk about that bromance. What sort of things has Trump done to support Netanyahu?
So there have been several measures that Trump has taken since he came to power. He first made a break away from longstanding U.S. policy by recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
I have determined that it is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Which is contentious because Palestinians claim the eastern side of the city as the capital of their future state. And then since then, there have been a series of messages that have been seen as punishing towards the Palestinians. Trump severely cut U.S. aid to Palestinians in the millions of dollars. And most recently, just a couple of weeks ago, Trump recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is a piece of occupied territory that Israel captured from Syria.
Israel took control of the Golan Heights in 1967 to safeguard its security from external threats.
And that concerns the Palestinians because they're worried that it sets a precedent of recognizing territory that is considered occupied as part of Israel, and that could affect the West Bank in the future.
Oliver, you spoke to one expert on the region who said that if Netanyahu wins, the right is going to be even more emboldened. What do you think that means for the region?
I think that if Netanyahu wins, that there will be a continuation of what he has been doing already, which is to entrench the occupation, to continue with settlements. What it means for the region is that Netanyahu's key foreign policy issues will continue, which have been largely focused against Iran. And that has been supported by both Washington and also Riyadh and Saudi Arabia. And that seems to be a big regional result of Netanyahu winning this election, is that there'll be continuing antagonism towards Iran. And who knows where that will take us.
Oliver, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can follow Oliver Holmes's reporting and all the results as they come in overnight at theguardian.com. Next, the reality of life for Gypsy, Roma and traveller communities in the UK. Now, a 2-year inquiry by a parliamentary committee has concluded that the government has comprehensively failed Gypsy, Roma and traveller communities in Britain. Sherry Smith is a Roma businesswoman and campaigner.
We get refused entry to pubs. That's par for the course. You walk into a pub, it's not, I'm going in to get a drink, it's, are we going to get served? We daily report racism. We daily have reports in of breweries, cinemas, bowling alleys that just don't let you in just because you're a traveller. We have poor outcomes in all the key areas, as this inquiry points to, such as health, education. The report is good, but there is some stuff we're not happy with. Some of the stuff about taking our children out of school, like it's elected home education. No, it's not elected. I mean, only 12% of our children will finish school with GCSEs. We don't opt out. You have to consider the effect that prejudice and discrimination has on the psychological and the physical health of gypsies and travellers, especially our young people. There hasn't been any research done into it. There is about to be some done, but we know that gypsies, Roman travellers, the suicide rates are much higher. We know that the depression's much higher. We know by research that has been done that you will die 10 to 15 years earlier. You know, it comes out in this report. We know that of the wider public, 1 in 100 women will suffer the loss of a child. In Gypsies and Travellers, it's 1 in 5. And we need some answers for that. I would like to think that this inquiry will make a difference and the government will do more. However, I think the fact that the report has nothing about accommodation really in it shows that the government aren't listening. Everything is underpinned by housing. And when, you know, we come away from the fact of 75% of us are in bricks and mortar accommodation, not by choice. You know, many of us would rather still be on the road or on sites. You know, we know that planning is not determined fairly. If you're a gypsy or a traveller, it will be determined differently. We know that local community groups rally themselves against gypsy and travellers, even if it's only for 1 or 2 pitches on a privately owned piece of land. And we know that even though the government have allocated funding to support site provision, we know that very often local councils don't want to take that up because it doesn't buy votes, you know. people don't want a gypsy or traveller in their backyard. I think that government policy definitely shapes people's perception of gypsies and travellers. So some of the terminology they use, it makes a lot of difference. For example, at my organisation, we map the hate crime, we physically map it, and we can see that when there's an MP or a councillor who issues a statement that could be really inflammatory hate speech about gypsies and travellers, then you'll see the hate crime reports go up in that area. I worry because what's given out by the media and by some policy, some of the language they use in policy, is that, you know, we choose this situation for ourselves and we don't. A few years ago, the government funded Gypsy Roma Traveller History Month for a couple of years and then it disappeared and fell away. And I think that's a real shame. There should have been a recommendation to be reinstated. Good practice models show that when schools, museums, libraries and places of work use Gypsy Roma Traveller History Month, it humanises us to the rest of society, it normalises us. Gypsy Roma Traveller people feel that they are at best ignored and at worst actively discriminated against by public services and policy making. And what this does is make it difficult for us to access everything, employment, health, a wider life. And what that ends up doing is that gypsies, Romans and travellers close themselves off to wider society.
That's all for today. My thanks to Sherry Smith and to Oliver Holmes. And thank you for listening to Today in Focus. Do let us know what you think. Leave us a comment on your podcast app. Today's episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Amy Walker. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We will see you tomorrow.